The water cascaded over him from the fountain in the cliff, and he shuddered and gasped with the cold, and then reached up into the dark rocky opening, found a finger hold, drew a deep breath, and then pulled himself upwards. With a solid black jet of water racing over his head, he held his breath and wriggled frantically up into the hole in the cliff. The force of water opposed him, and it required all his strength to go against it. Inch by inch, his chest throbbing for air, he fought his way upwards, and then just when he knew he would have to let himself be washed back into the pool, his head broke out, and he could breathe. He sucked air desperately, wedging shoulders and knees against the smooth, water-polished rock to hold himself in the torrent. It was utterly dark, not the faintest glimmering of starlight, and the darkness seemed to have physical weight that threatened to crush him. He reached as high as he could and found another smooth finger-hold, and with all the strength of his arms gained another few feet, rested a moment, and then reached up again. The rock was like glass, and in places coated with a thick beard of algae, slippery as an eel's skin. The cold was a terrible living thing that invaded his body. His bones ached, and his fingers were so numbed that he could barely take his holds. The water tore at him, battering his shoulders, forcing its way into his nose and mouth and ears, filling his head with its angry animal roaring. Still he went up in the irregular twisting tunnel, sometimes horizontal, wriggling forward on his belly, the roof cracking his skull as he lifted his head too quickly to find the few precious inches of air trapped beneath it. Mostly the tunnel climbed vertically, and he wedged with knees and elbows to hold himself against the cascade, while his skin, softened with water, was smeared and torn away in slabs against the stone. But the inches became yards, and the minutes became hours, and still he went up. Then the tunnel narrowed so sharply that he was trapped. Cold, slippery rock at each shoulder, and hard, heavy rock cramming down between his shoulder blades. He could not go on, nor could he go back. He was trapped in the rocky maw of the mountain, and he screamed with terror. But his voice was lost in the thunder of water, and the water gushed into his throat. He fought with the last of his drowning, desperate strength, and suddenly he kicked himself forward into a narrow cavern, where he could breathe again, and where the water swirled into little back eddies, so that he could rest a few moments from its drag. Even while he coughed and choked on his flooded lungs, he realized that he had lost his assegai, and he groped for it until he felt the tug of the thong on his shoulder. There was still something tied to the other end. Hand over hand, he drew in the thong, and then his fingers closed on the familiar shaft, and he sobbed with relief and pressed his lips to the beloved steel. It took time for him to realize that the air in the tiny cavern was sweet, and he felt it moving like a lover's fingers on his skin, warm and soft. Warmth. That was what made his heart sore. Warmth from the outside world, beyond this icy, roaring tomb of water. He found the shaft, down which the torrent was sucking air from the surface, and from somewhere came the strength to attempt it. He climbed slowly, agonizingly, and suddenly there was a white prick of light ahead of him, distorted by racing black water. He thrust his head forward, and the night wind struck his cheek, and he smelled wood smoke and grass and earth, redolent of the lingering warmth of the sun, and the great white star stood in the night sky high above his head. That dreadful passage had connected the fountain at the base of the cliff to the one high above. He did not have the strength to drag himself more than a few feet from the fountainhead, and there, under a bush in the soft bed of leaf mould, he lay and panted like a dog. He must have drifted into an exhausted and cold drug sleep, for he awoke with a start. The sky had paled. He could just see the branches of the bush above his head outlined against it. He dragged himself out, and he found that he ached down to the bones of his spine, and his skinned elbows and knees burned even at the touch of the dawn wind. There was a narrow path, well marked by many feet from the fountainhead, up the last few feet of the cliff, and as he stepped out onto it, he looked down and saw far below him the moon's silver forest and the tiny sparks that were the watchfires of his own bivouac. As he moved, he felt his muscles easing and unknotting, felt the blood recharging his limbs. Although he was ready for one, there was no sentry at the top of the path, and he peered out cautiously from behind the stone portals of the gully onto the tranquil village. By Chaka's teeth, they sleep like fat and lazy dogs, Butso thought grimly. The doors were all tightly closed. The smoke oozed from every chink in the walls. They were half suffocating themselves to keep out the mosquitoes. He could hear a man coughing hoarsely in the nearest hut. He was about to slip out from behind his rocky screen when faint movement in the gloom between the huts made him sink gently down again. A dark figure scurried directly towards where he hid. He shifted his grip on the assegai, but only a few paces from him the figure stopped. It was swathed in a skin cloak against the pre-dawn chill, hunched up like an old woman until it straightened and threw off the cloak. Butso felt his breath hiss up his throat, and he bit down to stop it reaching his lips. The naked girl was in that lovely, tender stage just past puberty, on the very brink of full womanhood. There were the last vulnerable vestiges of childhood in the plump little buttocks, and in the kitten, awkward way she stood with toes turned slightly inwards. She was naked, and the first light touched her sable skin with a lemon glow. Then she turned her head. She had a long, slender neck, and the neat little head balanced perfectly upon it. The dome of her skull was covered with an intricate pattern of closely woven plaits. Her forehead was high and smooth, her cheekbones vaulted in the Egyptian way, her lips chiselled into perfect sweeps, symmetrical as the wings of a beautiful butterfly. And the light glinted briefly in her huge slanted eyes as she looked about her. Then she squatted briefly, and her water tinkled against the earth. It was a sound that unaccountably filled Butzo's chest with a swollen, tender feeling, for the act was so innocent and so natural. She stood, and in the instant before she covered her head once more with the cloak, he had one more glimpse of her face. He knew then that he had never seen anything so beautiful in all his life, and he stared after her as she hurried back between the huts with a peculiar aching hunger consuming his very being. It took him many minutes to rouse himself, and then as he crept forward he found that, hard as he tried, he could not drive the girl's image from his mind. The pathway that led from the village to the ladder drawbridge was unmistakable. It was broad and its surface beaten smooth. There were walls of worked stone on each side of it, behind which the defenders could meet any thrust up the path. There were piles of stones at intervals along its course, placed ready to be hurled down at anybody attempting to force the ladder or fight their way up the path. The pathway dropped steeply into the gully, and then ended on a wide, level stone platform. The light was stronger now, and Butso could see that there were sentries here. Two of them stood on the lip watching the plain 50 feet below the platform, guarding the massive counterbalanced ladder. Further back, four other guards squatted around a small smoky fire, and Butso's saliva flooded as he smelled the roasting maize cakes. The men were talking in the low, sleepy tones of men who had stood a long watch, and their backs were turned to the gully, for they would never expect an enemy to come from that direction. Butso crept closer. There was another pile of rocks at the corner of the platform, ready for the guards to hurl down the cliff. Butso crawled into the shadows behind it. He did not have long to wait. Very faintly, on the morning wind, he heard the singing. Zama had begun the dance below the cliff. The song was the fighting hymn of his regiment, and Butso's blood thrilled in his veins. He felt the divine madness begin. It was a feeling that other lesser men got only from the hemp pipe. He felt the sweat break on his skin and the madness mount from his belly to his heart, felt the blood swell in his throat, felt his eyes burn and bulge. The guards had left the fire now and crowded the edge of the cliff, peering downwards, laughing and pointing. "Hear Loban Gula's puppies yap. Look at them dance like virgins at the festival of first fruits." The signal Butso had agreed with Zama was the moment the battle song ended. But he could barely contain himself that long. He rose from his crouch, and his muscles twitched. His head jerked like that of a maniac, and in the dawn light his eyes were glazed like shards of ceramic pottery, the red rage of the berserker. At that instant, the distant song ended. Butzo's cry froze the men on the edge of the cliff. It was the bellow of a heart-struck buffalo bull, the screech of the stooping eagle. In the paralyzed moment before they could turn, Butzo struck them. He charged with outstretched arms and swept four of them away into the void. They twisted and turned in the air as they fell, and they screamed the whole way down on a high receding note that was cut off abruptly at the end. Butzo's charge had been so headlong that he almost followed them over the brink. For a giddy moment he tottered there, and then he caught his balance and spun to strike underhand at one of the survivors. The blade went into the man's belly and out the other side, cleaving his bowels and his kidneys, and crunching through his backbone. And when Butzo jerked the steel clear, the lifeblood sprayed hotly over his forearm and his chest. The last sentry ran silently and desperately for the pathway, and Butzo let him go. He bounded along the edge of the cliff and reached the point where the top of the ladder was secured. The ropes that held it were of twisted and plaited bark, reinforced with liana and leather thongs. They were thick as Butzo's arm, and he changed his grip on the assegai to a chopping stroke. The ropes popped and crackled as he hacked through them. He grunted at each stroke, slitting his eyes against the flying chips of wood and bark. Behind him he heard the babble of many voices on the pathway. The sentry would call them down like hunting dogs, but Butzo scorned to turn until the work was done. One rope gave, and the massive, unwieldy ladder sagged and twisted. He cut again, reversing his grip to swing backhanded, and the other ropes went. The ladder swung outwards and downwards, gathering momentum, and the timbers crackled and squealed, drowning out the voices of the men coming down behind him. The bottom of the ladder struck the scree below the cliff with a shattering crash, and some of the uprights snapped under the impact. The head of the ladder was still secured at Butzo's feet, and the whole twisted mess hung down like the rigging of a dismasted ship. Butzo stood long enough to watch Zama lead his warriors swarming up the dangling tangle of rope and timber. Then he turned. They were coming down the pathway, a solid phalanx of black bodies and sparkling weapons. But their advance was hesitant enough for Butzo to race forward and reach the narrow gap in the wall before the leaders did. With solid rock to guard his flanks, he laughed at them, and it was a sound to stop them dead, those in front pushing back and those behind struggling forward. One of them threw a long spear, and it clashed sparks from the wall at the level of Butzo's head. He drove forward and stabbed into the press of bodies caught in the narrow gut between the stone walls. The screams and moans goaded him, and the blood from the gaping wound splattered his face and sprayed into his open mouth, a ghastly draught that maddened him further. They broke and fled, leaving four of their number writhing and twisting on the pathway. Butzo glanced behind him. None of his Matabili had reached the head of the ladder yet. He looked back up the pathway and saw that the real men were coming. These would be the picked warriors, the best spearmen. There was no mistaking their superiority over the rabble that Butzo had just scattered. They were bigger and more powerful in body, their expressions grim and determined, and their formation ordered and controlled. They came down in massed ranks to where Butzo stood, their shields raised, their spears poised, and at their head danced a skinny, wizened old man with a face ravaged by some terrible disease, his nose and ears rotted away, and his cheeks and forehead covered with silver-white blotches. He was hung about the waist and neck with the accoutrement of his magical trade, and he shrieked and gibbered like an enraged ape. "Kill the Matabili dog!" Butzo was naked, without a shield, but he hefted the assegai and stood to meet them, and their horrid master, and he laughed again, the wild, joyous laughter of a man who was living a lifetime in his last few seconds. "Butzo!" The cry reached him even through his rage, and he turned. Zama had crawled onto the platform, blown from that long scrambling climb up the swinging twisted ladder. He rose on his knees and sent the great dappled shield skimming across the platform. Like a falcon coming to bait, it settled on Butzo's shoulder, and Butzo laughed and went springing forward. His assegai drove through the wizard's rotting flesh as though it was soft as a boiled yam, and Pemba screeched one last time. "Butzo, wait! Leave some of them for us!" The shouts of his 50 Matabili behind him as they scrambled onto the platform, and then Zama's muscled shoulder was touching him as they locked shields and swept the pathway, the way the flash floods of summer scour the dry riverbeds. It was a beautiful stabbing, a glory which men would sing about. The assegai seemed to hold their keen edge, no matter how often they were buried, and the spear arms never tired, despite the heavy work. The line of Matabili swept the hilltop from end to end, roaring their frustration when the last of Pemba's men threw down their spears and leapt out over the cliff, grudging them that easy death, for the assegais were still thirsty and the madness was still on them. Then they turned and went back through the village, ransacking the huts, throwing a toddling infant high and catching it on the point as it fell, or sending the steel full length out between the withered dugs of some scurrying crone, for the divine madness does not pass swiftly. With his shoulder, Butzo smashed open another hut, and Zama leapt in at his side. Both of them were painted from throat to knee with red running crimson, their contorted faces hideous, blood-glutted masks. Someone tried to escape from the dark interior of the hut. "Mine!" roared Zama, and sped his long steel, and the low early sun struck a ray through the opening doorway, sparkling on Zama's assegai, and falling in the same instant on the huge, slanted, terrified eyes and high Egyptian cheekbones of the girl he was killing. Zama's steel clashed against Butzo's great shield and was deflected past the girl's cheek by the width of a finger, so that the stroke died in the air. Before Zama could strike again, Butzo stood over the girl, spreading the shield over her the way a heron covers its chick with a wing, and he snarled at Zama like a leopard whose cub is menaced. After the first weary day of the return march, while the long file of roped captives was settling exhausted and miserable beneath the grove of masasa trees, Butzo strode down the line and stopped beside the girl. "You," he said, and with a careless stroke of his assegai severed the thong at her neck, "cook my meal." While she worked over the fire, Butzo joked loudly with Zama and his men, trying to prevent his eyes from straying from their faces. He ate what she cooked without showing either pleasure or displeasure, while she knelt at a respectful distance and watched every mouthful he took. Then suddenly, when he had finished eating, she came gliding to his side with that disconcerting, silent grace, and she lifted the bunch of wilted leaves from the swollen and crusted spear wound in Butzo's flank. It was an impertinence, and he lifted his hand to strike her, and let the hand fall. She had not flinched, and her manner was assured and competent. She cleaned the wound with deft fingers, and then she unstoppered two of the little buckhorn containers that she wore on her belt, and with the powder they contained, made a poultice. It burned like fire for a few seconds, but then felt much easier. Butzo made no acknowledgement, but when one of his Matabili came to rope her back with the other captives, Butzo frowned, and the man passed by her. When Butzo lay on his sleeping mat, she curled like a puppy at his feet. He was ready for her to try to escape once the camp settled, but after midnight she had not stirred, and he fell asleep. In the hour before dawn, when he rose to check the sentries, there was frost on the grass, and he heard the girl's teeth chattering softly. He dropped his fur regimental cloak over her as he passed, and she cuddled down into it quickly. When he called for the day's march to begin, she had his bedding roll and cooking pot balanced on her head, and a dozen times during the march, Butzo had to go back along the winding column for no reason that he could explain to Zama, and each time his steps slowed as he came up behind the girl, and he watched the play of muscle down her back, the roll of her plump black buttocks, and the joggle of her glossy sable breasts. But when she turned her head and smiled shyly at him, his hauteur was frosty, and he stalked back to the head of the column. That night he permitted himself a nod of approval at the first taste of her cooking, and when she dressed the wound, he said, "The heat has gone from it." She did not lift her eyes. Who taught you this skill? He insisted.
Pemba, the wizard,
she whispered.
Why? I was his apprentice. Why you? I have the gift.
So then, little witch, make me an oracle, Batso laughed. And she lifted her head, and he looked into those disconcerting, slanted, tar-bright eyes.
Do not scoff, Lord. Nkosi, Lord, she called him.
But Batso stopped laughing, and felt the spirits tickle the hair at the nape of his neck.